Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The story goes that 1,000 years ago, Japanese imperial lady-in-waiting Murasaki Shikibu sat down in the moonlight of a temple outside Kyoto and began to write. Her great tale of love and longing and court intrigue is The Tale of Genji. In Japan, they've been celebrating its 1,000th anniversary. This hour on Point Inside The Tale of Genji, you can join the conversation. Do you know this Japanese classic tale of an imperial Don Juan, perhaps the world's first novel? Are you ready to recognize familiar human psychology in a tale from far away and 1,000 years ago? Joining me today from Pasadena, California, is Lynn Miyake. She is a professor of Japanese, Asian, and Women's Studies at Pomona College and a scholar of The Tale of Genji and the life of its author. Lynn Miyake, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much.
And
nice
with
to be on here,
it's
Tom.
Great to have you. And with us from Berkeley, California, is Liza Dalby, novelist, anthropologist, and author of The Tale of Murasaki, a historical novel about the life of Murasaki Shikibu, the woman who wrote The Tale of Genji. Liza Dalby, thank you very much for being here today.
Hello, Tom. It's a pleasure.
It's great to have you both, and I can't wait to dive into this. It's a rare opportunity to talk about a book 1,000 years old. 1,008, I guess, is the date that's often given for the end of the writing of this book that Liza Dalby was produced sort of like Dickens produced his books, produced a bit at a time. By whom, for whom, Liza?
You know, we don't really know, but the interesting thing about the year 2008, you can actually become even more precise than that. The Japanese have declared November 1st, 2008, to be Classics Day. There was a proclamation made on that day by their Imperial Highnesses, the Emperor and Empress. And the reason it's that day is because the very first mention of the Tale of Genji in a historical source, and the historical source is Murasaki Shikibu's diary, is from a description of a kind of drunken party where one of the courtiers says, "Hey, is our little Murasaki around anywhere?" And that refers to one of the major characters in the book. So because that particular entry can be dated so precisely, that's why they chose that day and that year. And it's Classics Day, and the Tale of Genji is about the most classic of all the Japanese classics.
And they've been celebrating all over the place, not just Kyoto, but we've got comic books and movies and every sort of thing under the sun for Genji this year. Lynn Miyake, who was this woman 1,000 years ago writing Dickens-style, kind of chapter or bit at a time, and who would she have been presenting these stories to?
Murasaki Shikibu was a very interesting woman and actually is a member of what we call the provincial governor class, and this is where the group from which many of the very famous women writers of the period emerged. They were very literate certainly in Japanese, but actually they wrote in a hybrid style and were very proficient in classical Chinese, even though they did not receive necessarily formal training. Her audience, I think, is a very interesting group. It's I would consider a very small in-group, a very circumscribed group of courtiers, the imperial family, the courtiers and their family, and also there's a salon or two in the clerical circles as well, because these clerics were often men of means and really aristocrats as well. So we have a very small in-group in which they were the producers, the consumers, and also the topics of all or many of the works that were produced in this period.
So, and here we go for a little summary. This is from The Economist magazine. They say, ruthlessly summarized, the book's storyline goes like this. The, quote, dazzlingly lovely Genji, son of the emperor and one of his lower grade consorts, is irresistible to women. He enjoys a string of affairs as a young man, even abducting a 10-year-old girl so he can mold her into the perfect life companion.
But sleeping with the daughter of the leader of the opposing political faction, one indiscretion too many, Genji is forced into exile, recalled eventually to the capital, builds himself a mansion with a different woman in each of its four wings. Honors are heaped upon him. He's offered the retired emperor's daughter as a wife. But his royal bride betrays him with another man. When his beloved mistress dies after a long illness, our heartbroken hero follows her swiftly to the grave. Liza, that is a very rough and brief summary of a book that in English is way over 1,000 pages long.
Oh, it's even longer in Japanese, Tom.
It's
like 13 volumes.
Put it in your words. How do you describe the story to someone who's never cracked the book?
Well, it sounds like a soap opera, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does. And even more when you get in the details.
Like,
I mean, he sleeps with his stepmother, has a child by her, affairs all over the place. You know, yes, it does.
Well, you know, there's one point where you often hear Genji described as a Japanese Casanova, a mm-hmm. Japanese Don Juan, because mm-hmm. he has all of these affairs with different women. But I think that really misses the point. If you think about the way Genji treats women, whereas Casanova or Don Juan is like a black hole. They're never satisfied. They never find the perfect woman, and they use women like Kleenex, throw them away. But Genji never throws anyone away. A few of the women have escaped him, and they've gone off to become nuns. But he takes care and treasures every single one, and that's the point of building this mansion where he has the women who were important to him arrayed around him. He even takes care of one of his father's sort of old, neglected concubines. And I think that's very important, and I think that was very important to the readership at the time. Genji was an idealized figure, but he was someone that, that women... He just embodied the masculine ideals of that age.
A heartthrob then and now. Here's Lady Murasaki in the Tale of Genji describing him, the shining Genji, the shining prince, at 17. She says, "Over soft, layered white gowns, he had only a dress cloak, unlaced at the neck. Lying there in the lamplight against a pillar, he looked so beautiful that one could have wished him a woman." Lin Miyake, that kind of description is repeated again and again in here. This is the irresistible masculine beauty.
Right. And I would say that I guess in Japanese literature or even culture, we have two kinds of heroes, the quote-unquote soft hero and the tough or hard hero. I guess the latter would be the samurai and bushido and that strain. And here we have a soft hero. And I think we are having a resurgence of that kind of hero really in a lot of the popular media production now, anime and manga as well. And so it is very interesting to see a male figure who probably by American standards would not be necessarily very attractive, being the ideal male figure in at this period of time.
He's no John Wayne, but he might be a kind of Jude Law. I don't know. How does Genji play in contemporary Japan, Lin? I mean, it is, as you say, in the manga, in the Japanese comics today, but in some different ways, sometimes almost soft porn, other times presented as the great classic, like Japan's Shakespeare.
Right. There are 23 versions, actually, of manga or comic versions of The Tale of Genji, and only actually one of them is what we would consider soft porn. It is true that there are a series in which he appears as the male ideal for the female protagonists in ladies' comics. But on the whole, I think he generally plays out the role of a wonderful man who is the ideal for every single woman, I suppose. And some of the central manga that have been written are for the girls or shoujo manga. And so there, he's the dashing, captivating hero. So many of the complexities, I think, of Genji are not necessarily reproduced in the modern versions.
Liza, is he also a philosophical seeker, not just a seeker for love?
Well, he is. And I think... along those lines, there's been a number of Japanese scholars recently who tend to see Genji as really a rhetorical device that Murasaki Shikibu, as a writer, used him really mainly to be able to describe all these different kinds of women that he visits. And so he becomes the device that pulls the tale together, but it's not really a tale about the shining Genji so much as it is about the women that he has affairs with.
So the beautiful man becomes a lens or the connective thread that lets Murasaki describe all the women who fall for him and around him.
Well, that's certainly possible.
Lynn?
I do very much agree with what Liza has said, and I have mentioned that to many of my friends who are Genji scholars, and they are very adamant that we must not forget Genji, that without Genji, really, there would be no story. So in a sense, he is a kind of empty center, which serves, I guess, as an excuse for the women to appear on stage. However, without Genji, there would be no story, but the conception, I guess, of characterization in Japanese literature is very interesting. You don't have full-fledged figures, that you actually need the merging of two characters to bring out the psychological depth, the sense of being or character of the other personality. And it's only in the wedding of the meeting of these two characters in which you get a sense of who the full character of Genji is and also the women.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Japan's great tale of ancient court life and intrigue, the tale of Genji. Now, 1,000 years old and counting. Very lucky today to be joined by Lynn Miyake from Pomona College, professor of Japanese, Asian, and Women's Studies there, and from Berkeley, California, by Liza Dalby, novelist and cultural anthropologist, author of The Tale of Murasaki. It's a historical novel about the life of Murasaki Shikibu. Liza Dalby spent a lot of time in Japan, famously in the 70s, living a couple of years as herself a geisha there and writing about that in her book, Geisha. Let's go to Susanna in Bethany, Connecticut. Susanna, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to talk about how I got introduced to this amazing book. 30 years ago, I was a freshman in a survey course that the students referred to as rice paddies at Harvard, and it was basically an introduction to East Asia. And one of the people who was brought in to lecture on Japanese literature, which at the time I had no interest in whatsoever, was this wonderful man named Howard Hibbett. And he delivered a lecture on the tale of Genji that had this lecture hall full of 300 usually noisy freshmen just awestruck.
And what was it about that lecture, about the core of his presentation? Was it that beautiful Shining Prince or something about...
It was not just that. It was his description of the sensibilities of Heian Japan, this amazing, and the court life in particular, this amazing world where women weren't allowed to show their faces and people would fall in love with each other just by seeing the fragment of a gown peeking out below a screen or out of the door of a carriage or something like that. And they would send, little boy messengers with poems after spending a night together, and this world in which a Genji would burst into tears just by looking at a flower or a garden or a waterfall or something like that, but then he read a passage from the book, and you could have heard a pin drop in that lecture hall. And as I said, I walked into that lecture with not the slightest interest in Japanese literature, and I ended up signing up for his course the next year, and, it led to a lifelong love of Japanese literature. I actually made my way through the entire I don't know, 77 volumes of the thing. And it's something that, you know, I've carried with me to this very day.
All the way to that great last chapter with its title, Floating Bridge of Dreams. Susanna, you bring it back to us vividly, and I appreciate that so much. Thanks for calling there. Liza W., what about that sensibility, just a wisp of a little siding of the hem of someone's kimono or the side of the blossom? Is that exoticizing, or is that what the Heian sensibility was in the court?
Oh, I don't think it's exoticizing. In fact, my first experience with the Genji very much mirrors Susanna's. I first read it when I was 16. This was my very first taste of Japan. I had never been there. And growing up in Indiana, I was a child who always liked nature. I liked flowers and insects and animals and seasons. And, you know, in Indiana, we had cherry trees, but when they would bloom in the spring, nobody really made much of a deal about it. And I discovered in the world of Genji a world where people made a huge deal about that. And, you know, cherry blossoms were a metaphor for life, and people saw nature and seasons through these wonderful and poetic metaphors. And to me, I felt like this is a home. This was a vocabulary to talk about things that were very important to me that just did not exist in my Midwestern life.
We can well hear that, and suddenly a cherry blossom is much more, and even over 1,000 years. Lynn, I wish you'd begin to read a little bit for us. We had marked out something at the very beginning, but I wonder if you'd go forward a little bit to this seduction scene and give us a bit in Japanese, if you'd be good enough. And then this is a scene where Genji has taken his lover, one of them, Yugao, to a deserted mansion, but she's possessed by a spirit. The spirit manages to kill the lover. Can you give us a little bit in Japanese and then in English, Lynn?
Okay, this will be a rendering of classical Japanese that is not true to the period, but as best as we can do it, I guess, in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. Okay, and I begin. Yoi suguru hodo, skoshi neiri tamaeru ni, on makura gami ni ito okashige naru onna ite, ono ga ito medetashi to mitate matsuru oba, tazune 思う差で各異なる異なき人をいておわして時めかしたもうこそ意図目覚ましく辛けれとてこの音かたわらの人をかき起こさんと見たもうものに教わる心地しておどろきたまえれば火も消えにけり. That's the end of the passage.
And
you're correct that it describes that scene where there's a ghostly figure who appears at the bedside of Genji as he lays asleep with his new lady. Mm-hmm. And the figure really charges Genji with neglecting her. And it's not clear from the Japanese whether she actually kills the woman. Mm-hmm. The text seems to indicate that she shakes the woman, but she does die. And I think the other more modern renditions have assumed and indicated very clearly that this ghostly apparition has killed Yugao.
And in that passage, do you hear the kind of extra delicate sensibility that we're hearing from our caller and what excited Liza in Indiana all those years ago?
I think this one is a little bit more of not so much the sensibility in terms of nature, but certainly the delicacy, I guess, in which this very horrifying scene is still described. It doesn't say that the ghostly apparition killed Yugao. So I think in that sense, we do have a touch of the more thoughtful sensibility about death and about the women. And certainly, I think in the sense of what the ghost says to Genji, it is, again, couched in very formalized language. I think the jealousy is very much contained and rendered in not directly oppressive language. Sort of the sense of someone yelling at someone at the top of their voices or anything like that, but it's always depicted in very thoughtful, not, I wouldn't say thoughtful, very subdued language. But I guess this is not the greatest scene, in a sense, to talk about the sensibilities, I think.
Michelle Green, but Eliza, please, yeah.
Oh, sorry. I think this does raise a very interesting point about the Genji, which is that there is so much that is unsaid because Murasaki could, she had such a small readership and she didn't have to say a lot and she knew that they would understand what was involved. But that means that for modern readers, we often have to supply a lot of the knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And personally, I think this is one thing that makes the Tale of Genji so powerful, because the reader has to work somewhat. You bring your own emotional experiences to it, and then it sticks with you more.
Not least, people have to work, because in those days, in the original scroll, the characters were not presented by name, but rather by position, and positions changed over time.
That made sense to them. That's a little harder modern readers to deal with.
And then it's just chock-a-block with classical poetry, which they would have known and shared as a kind of cultural language so intimately that they didn't always feel the necessity to even complete the line or the line of poetry, sort of in the, you know, when in Rome, we don't have to complete that. They knew just from a snippet.
Yeah. Well, you know, this was a real issue for me in writing the historical novel, because I felt that it was my responsibility to supply a lot of these details that modern Western readers are not going to know. I think a very good example of that is the fact that you can read through the whole 1,000-page Tale of Genji and not realize that all of these beautiful ladies that Genji had affairs with had black teeth. Because this
in the
was
style
the cosmetic,
of the time. Mm-hmm.
This was the cosmetic convention. A beautiful woman, of course, blackened her teeth.
Right.
But Murasaki never wrote that. She didn't need to write that. Her readers just assumed that. So those were the kinds of things that I felt I had to add in and describe in my novel, but also describe them from a Heian 11th century perspective to make it appear as if this were cosmetic beautification, because that's how they thought of it.
Amazingly, wonderfully, Murasaki's diary survives, and we can, and you have read deeply from it. You've got a little bit from the diary of the author. I wonder if you could share with us, Liza.
Oh, I do. And the diary as it exists is fragmentary, but it offers tantalizing glimpses of Murasaki the person. And just wanted to say in the beginning, this was very common for court men and women to keep diaries, but they're somewhat different. A man's diary would tend to be just a record of, you know, what happened day by day. But women would tend to record their activities and then include detailed descriptions with personal reflections and often put poetry in their diaries. So I think they're very, very appealing to a modern reader. They seem very intimate. So here's a section when Murasaki has come home. She's been in court. She's very depressed. And I think this depression sounds quite existential and quite modern. I was very struck by this when I first read it. So she writes, "Seeing the water birds on the lake, I thought to myself how nice it would be if it snowed before we got back to the palace. The garden would look so beautiful. And then 2 days later, while I was at home for a short visit, it did snow. But looking out over my own shabby garden, it only made me depressed. I couldn't shake the feeling that for some time I had been merely existing from day to day, dully registering the passage of time by taking note of the flowers, the singing birds, the way the sky changed from season to season, the moon, the frost, the snow. But in fact, I was quite indifferent. What did any of it mean? The thought of continuing on in this isolated state was almost unbearable. Yet there had been friends with whom I could discuss trifling matters, and even those with whom I could exchange my innermost thoughts. I had even rubbed elbows with the high and mighty and prided myself that I could deal with any of these people on their own terms. Keenly aware of my own insignificance, at least I had been able to avoid anything shameful or unbecoming, and yet, in the end, I was weary of it all." And then she writes, "I tried rereading my tale, but it did not seem as good as I had once thought, and I was disappointed."
Well, Liza, I'll be reading from Murasaki Shikibu's diary, 1,000 years old and a very, very distant culture, and yet psychologically seems familiar. Let's get a call from Boston. And John. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
A number of years ago, I lost a dear friend of mine to cancer, and in sympathy, another friend of mine sent me a beautiful little passage, and I'll just read it to you.
Is this from Genji, John?
From Genji, mm-hmm. yes. And it's roughly translated, I guess. It's, "Oh, for a master of magic who might go and seek her spirit and by a message teach me where her spirit dwells." That's it. And I had a calligrapher draw it up on a piece of parchment.
1,000 years old and supporting you and a friend.
Absolutely.
in a time of grief.
I give it to other friends whom I know that have lost someone. I have it, and it's a lovely piece.
John, thank you very much for that. And let's get another call from Aaron in Lunenburg, Massachusetts. Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well.
Good. I took a Japanese cities and cultures class that really heavily focused on literature in college. And the reason I did it is because I was, my senior year. I had spent my entire education with Beowulf and the Canterbury Tales, mm-hmm. and all of this fabulous English literature. And I ran into a professor one day, and he said, "You know, there's more out there than just English lit." I said, "Yeah, but I haven't been exposed to it." And he said, "Take my class. You'll love it." And I loved it. I loved it. We read a lot of Japanese, old Japanese literature, but we read the Tale of Genji. It was great, but it was really interesting to see how it was split among gender lines, because the men were sitting there saying, "Yeah, you know, Genji's got his groove on. This is awesome."
Because the women flocked to him and fell around him, yes?
Oh, exactly. I just thought that was great.
How did you feel about it as an American woman in this time?
Well, you know, I threw a couple pencils across the room a couple times based on comments going, "That's kind of rude, you guys." But it was great. And the women were sitting in class sighing wistfully, "Oh, he's a sensitive man." And they just, all the women just thought, Genji's a hopeless romantic. And he, you know, one of your other callers, you know, made mention of the fact it's very subtle. It was the subtle sensuality of the novel, the tiniest thing that would just send Genji either into tears or into the stratosphere in love over a tiny thing, the attention to detail, the things that we as Americans would overlook, like the cherry blossoms. Who's going to sit there and write a poem about it, you know? Well, obviously in Japanese culture they did, and it was this attention to detail really gave rise to the subtle sensuality and his romanticism that just had all of us women swooning.
Aaron, you report it well and bring it back well. Thank you. Lynn Miyake?
Yes,
do you share that response, or is that a young, you know, young and in college response to Genji?
I think the response is actually dual. I think there is that sense that he is this ideal lover who satisfies everyone's concerns, and certainly ladies' comics and even the shoujo girls' comics mm-hmm. have really reiterated this interpretation over and over. Yet, at the same time, on the other hand, I think the readers, and especially the women and also the men, are quite concerned about the kind, you know, you mentioned in your summary, the abduction of a 10-year-old girl and mm-hmm. the dynamics of those kinds of encounters. So I think on the one hand, he is this incredible hero, but on the other, some of the things that were acceptable in that period can be troubling to many of the readers today.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Japan's great tale, the Tale of Genji, ancient court life and intrigue. Now 1,000 years old and counting, Lynn Miyake is with us from Pomona College in California, and Liza Dalby, novelist and cultural anthropologist, author of The Tale of Murasaki, which is a historical novel about the life of the author of The Tale of Genji. Let's turn to our listeners. Mark in New Britain, Connecticut, you're on the air.
Thank you. And ladies, thank you for having this discussion. I appreciate it greatly. I'm struck by something that one of you, forgive me, I cannot remember which one it was, said before the first break about how characterization in Genji is not a matter of looking at a single character, but of looking at the interaction between two characters, how a character is revealed through that intersection, if you will. And it struck a memory, something I've been given to understand about Japanese language, that in certain circumstances it's considered impolite to use the first person. And it set me to wondering, is this something that you see in other Japanese literature and culture, where there's this de-emphasis on the self, that empty center you spoke of, where one sort of dances around the self and looks more at interactions than directly at a person?
Wonderful. Let us pick it up, Mark. And Lynn, first to you. A character revealed in interaction rather than direct description. Is that embedded in the language, the culture? How do you hear that?
I think this would be the chicken or the egg story. It's hard to say which actually came first. But I guess in many ways I would characterize even regular interpersonal interactions among Japanese as what I term dialogic in a sense, or collaborative. And I think Liza already alluded to that, in the sense that the readers bring a great deal to the text, and they bring 50% or more of the information and meaning in order to understand and fully appreciate the text. So I think this is a very prominent feature of literature. And rather than, I guess, it would be impolite to reference the first person, I think it's more a sense that it's a sense of the speaker or the protagonist thinking of themselves always in relation and in conjunction to whomever they're interacting with. They almost often they speak or think or almost be from the perspective of their listeners as well as themselves. And so there's an incredible richness. So even as a reader, you're not supposed to be outside, as in a 19th century classic realist novel, but really you are invited and almost insisted upon that you enter the work and sit almost as one of the participants, listening and participating and interacting with the characters as well.
Maybe we can get a sense of that from The Tale of Genji itself. You've got, I think, another reading there, Lynn, that gets to this sort of psychological novel, the interior life, a scene where there's a lot of the thought and psychology revealed with this protagonist, Ukifune, one of the princesses, involved in a love triangle with two imperial princes, Genji's grandson and his supposed son. This is later in the book. You can hear in her thoughts maybe this tug of war between them in her heart.
Right. Okay. And I begin. The things he wrote most casually were the ones that afforded the greatest pleasure and delight. Not being especially given to weighty pondering, she felt the tug of his ardent feelings. And yet the gentleman who had claimed her earlier, yes, he was the one with greater depth and nobility, and also the first whom she had really known. And no doubt that is why she wondered what would happen if he heard about this unfortunate business and came because of it to reject me. What a blow that would be for my mother, too, when she so longs for him to come for me. And that man with his burning ardor, people keep telling me he is a hopeless gallant, which he may well be. Yet he still might hide me somewhere in the city and go on caring enough not to forget me. But then they are Her Highness's feelings to consider, since nothing in this world remains hidden for long. After all it took him was that single strange evening, and sure enough, he found me again. So obviously, his lordship could not possibly fail to find out what happened to me what happened to me either. Her mind ran on in this vein, and she was just reflecting how terrible it would be if her lapse should cause his lordship to turn against her when a messenger arrived with a letter from him.
From this passage,
it's very hard to... it starts out really looking at her from a third-person perspective. Suddenly it's I, and then there's so many he's that you can't tell which of the lovers are being referred to.
Right. But we can follow along with the feelings easily enough 1,000 years later, and it's kind of an incredible feeling. Let's go to Santee, South Carolina, and Mike. Mike, you're on the air.
ahead, Tom. How are you doing?
Very well. What do you hear, Mike?
Well, what I'm interested in is this claim I heard a couple of times in the earlier part of the hour about this being the world's first novel. I'm wondering how your guests are defining novel, since I'm sure their colleagues in classics departments and who study late antiquity have worked, for example, on the proliferation of work on the Greek novel, or I think in Syriac, the Hymn of the Pearl or the Julian romance that predate this by several centuries. So how is this first novel idea being?
It's a great question, Mike, and we should pick it up. And I should say I'm not hanging the first novel tag or attributing it directly to Liza Dalby or Lynn Miyake, but it is made again and again, at least posited, that this may be the world's first modern novel, it's often put, or the first psychological novel. Liza, of course, it's debated, but how does the case get made?
Well, I think it's because the novel immediately brings you into the interior of people's thoughts, and that's what makes it different from a tale. Like an adventure tale, mm-hmm. of which there were several in Japan before this time, and Greek and Roman literature as well. I think those tales, which tend to be more action oriented, there's mm-hmm. a plot and things happen, but they don't really bring you inside the character's emotions, and that is so much the characteristic of the Tale of Genji, and I think it does strike readers as very modern.
Lynn, I know you're of mixed minds about this novel label put here, but how do you think about it?
I believe that in many ways it is a novel in the sense of its richness in terms of psychological description, the depth and care with which the characters are developed, the complexity of plot, and in many other aspects, as Liza has mentioned, of bringing in the reader fully to be fully engaged in the story. I suppose for me, I would not like the term novel to be appended really to this tale, because it hides other aspects, and basically in the narrative strategies, I call it the narrative triad between the text, the reader or audience, and the characters themselves, that there's a richness that is quite different, certainly from the 19th century classic realist novels, such as, by Dickens and so on, where the reader is really outside the text and is really not invited necessarily to be part of the action in the story. It also really, the term novel covers the fact that the language itself is in a very particular courtly women discourse and culture. So it has a very powerful orality issue or aspect to it, I should say, in which it is not, the story is told not in the past necessarily, that it is actually enacted in the present as if the reader and the narrator and the author are all participating at this moment. So again, perhaps for me, it is more from a narrative standpoint that I would not consider it a novel.
Jane Smiley, of course, the contemporary novelist, wrote not long ago, she asked, did Murasaki invent the novel in 1000 A.D.? Let's say she did, since no one but specialists read her rivals Daphne and Chloe or The Golden Ass, while The Tale of Genji is read in Japanese schools as Shakespeare is read in English and North American schools and has been fully translated into English 3 times in the past century. Let's say further, she writes, this is Jane Smiley, that she invented 2 types of novels, starting with the biographical and then gets on into the philosophical and poetic tradition. You've got a little reading, Liza Dalby. This is Murasaki within The Tale of Genji on the art of fiction. Maybe you could read it for us, get a sense of how she was thinking.
Sure. This is very interesting because you have the characters talking about what is fiction, what is a tale, a monogatari. But, we're led to think that this must be Murasaki's own ideas on the subject. Mm. So it's a it's in the rainy season, and Genji comes into the room of his a young girl he's taking care of. Her name is Tamakazura, and he's also romantically interested in her, but they have this conversation. So I begin. One day when Genji came into Tamakazura's rooms, He noticed several illustrated romances scattered about the place. "Really," he said with a smile, "you women are incorrigible. Look at these books. There probably isn't an ounce of truth in the lot of them, and you know that as well as I do. Yet here you are, utterly fascinated and taken in by all their fabrications. And, I may add, quite unaware that your hair is in the most frightful mess." Genji paused. "But then," he continued, "if it weren't for old romances like this, how on earth would you get through these long, tedious days? And besides, I realize that many of these works, full of fabrications though they are, do succeed in evoking the emotion of things in a most realistic way. One event follows plausibly on another, and in the end we cannot help being moved by the story, even though we know what foolishness it all really is. Thus, when we read about the ordeals of some delightful lady in a romance, we may find ourselves quite caught up in her plight. Later on, when we think back calmly on the story, we're annoyed that we should have swallowed it whole. But at first, we are fascinated."
Critique of fiction from 1,000 years ago. That's just great, and how true. Josie in Glastonbury, Connecticut. You're on the air, Josie.
Yes, hello. I wanted to thank Lisa Dalby for her novel. I read it when it first came out, and it had
The Tale of Murasaki.
Yes, The Tale of Murasaki.
Mm-hmm.
It made me first go and find The Tale of Genji and start reading that. I dip in and out of it. But also, I'm a professional artist, and I keep a journal for that reason. And the thing that fascinated me about The Tale of Murasaki and the whole story was that they communicated by poetry. And so I decided one year to, after reading Ms. Dalby's book, to keep my journal in haiku,
oh,
which is harder than you think when you're coming up with 17 syllables. But after I did that...
How's it go, like, car to Whole Foods?
Well,
broccoli, not
like,
so good.
You know, things like The Old Man in the Mountain fell in New Hampshire. That was one of them. And, you know, various
right.
things happened. But some of them were, when you get into haiku, they can be humorous, they can be about family things, they can also be zen. So it was really my journal. And as an artist, I'm used to having product, so I ended up doing an artist publication of the poems with my own, illustrated with my own photography, and using the oriental sensibility of the calligraphy and the image being integrated the way they did in their paintings.
Mm.
And also the red chop mark that often appears on that. I use the Japanese symbol for the season to lead you through the book.
Josie, you're a prisoner of Liza Dalby and the Genji. They've got you under their spell.
She sure did. Anyway, I wanted to thank her very much. She had a big influence on me.
That's fabulous. That's so lovely. Thank you for calling.
That's wonderful. Let's get one more. Dina in Lenox, Massachusetts. Dina, you're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Thanks very much. It's a wonderful, wonderful show. I wanted to just very quickly say that I was first introduced to The Tale of Genji when I was at a small Catholic girls' college in Indiana. And the president of the college only taught one course to us, and it was Japanese and Chinese literature, and Tale of Genji was just thrilling at the time. I continue to reread it all the time. And as I've grown older, I'm now a grandmother, I see it on very many different levels. It has informed my experience to Japan, seeing Murasaki's house. It's just been wonderful. And I have one very important question, which is, what is the best translation of the newer translations that you can recommend?
Oh, you're devilish to ask it with 2 minutes to go, but we've got translations from Arthur Whaley, the first in English, from Edward Seidensticker, who I knew well in my years of living in Tokyo, from Royal Tyler more recently. Where do your preferences go? Lynn, first you.
Royal Tyler, period. He is able to not only recreate the world, but also the language and the pacing. And it makes it difficult to read, as Liza has pointed out, because there are a lot of positions. The characters are referred to by position. But I think if you would like the full experience as much as possible, linguistically as well as culture and content, I think it's Royal Tyler.
Liza, how about you?
Oh, I totally agree. That's my favorite translation as well.
We've got here, I'm reading from a spokesman for the Genji Millennium Committee in Kyoto, says,
uh-huh.
we feel it is our responsibility to pass on the spirit of mono no aware, sensitivity to the lyrical beauty of things, to future generations in Japan and the world. Lynn, does Genji capture that Japanese spirit?
Yes, I think he does. And I think our callers, as well as Liza, have been talking about the incredible sensibility. It's sensual, understated. The silences and the spaces are as full of meaning as the actual words on the page. And the work really moves forward, not just in the romantic relationships, which in some ways is a kind of cover for all kinds of issues, political intrigue, religious and philosophical concerns, music history, really a story of life, love, and death.
The Tale of Genji at 1000 and Counting, Lynn Miyake at Pomona College. Thank you very, very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
And Liza Dalby, author of The Tale of Murasaki. Ms. Dalby, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, kochira koso. Thank you.
We'll go out with Elegy for Murasaki by Japanese composer Isao Tomita. Composed a work called The Tale of Genji Symphonic Fantasy, recorded in the year 2000. Enjoy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.